From WBUR Boston and WRNI Providence, this is Boston University's World of Ideas. I'm Ted O'Brien. Each week, we bring you the best of Boston University from the worlds of scholarship, letters, politics, and the arts. Tonight, Cedric Robinson on Jim Crow, capitalism, and the representation of blacks in early American cinema.
So you see the mulatto in being employed over and over and over again. This is the only instance I've given you of the film called The Nigger. That's the only instance of, I can find of a sympathetic treatment of the mulatto. But over and over and again in these films, mulattoes went crazy.
Tonight, how Hollywood helped shape society's attitudes toward African Americans in the first decades of the last century. On Boston University's World of Ideas. First, this news.
From NPR News in Washington, I'm Craig Windham. The State Department is ordering all non-essential diplomats and all embassy dependents to leave Kuwait City, Tel Aviv, Jerusalem, and Damascus because of the possibility of war with Iraq. The move comes after what the department calls an assessment of the security situation in the region. President Bush and the leaders of Britain and Spain say they'll make a final diplomatic push for a new UN resolution tomorrow. But after a whirlwind summit in the Azores, British Prime Minister Tony Blair said the lobbying in the Security Council will end tomorrow.
So now we have reached the point of decision, and we make a final appeal for there to be that strong, unified message on behalf of the international community that lays down a clear ultimatum to Saddam that authorizes force if he continues to defy the will of the whole of the international community set out in 1441.
That's the resolution passed by the Security Council last fall demanding that Saddam Hussein disarm. French President Jacques Chirac says he would accept a shorter schedule for UN inspections if that's what it takes to keep the Security Council working toward a diplomatic solution. NPR's Nick Spicer reports from Paris.
The French president said in an interview with American television that France would accept a period as short as 1 or 2 months to see if inspections can work. But Jacques Chirac added that it would be up to inspectors to say whether their work is producing results. He again rejected the idea that war is necessary right now. France has joined Russia and Germany in saying in a joint statement that inspections can work. The three countries called for an emergency meeting of foreign ministers on the UN Security Council. The meeting would take place after the next weapons inspectors report on Tuesday. The three countries have previously rejected the idea of a second resolution paving the path to war and British proposals linked to it. But the latest statement from Paris, Berlin, and Moscow says the unity of the Security Council can be preserved on the basis of those proposals. Nick Spicer, NPR News, Paris.
The New York City Police Department has reportedly developed a plan to protect the city in the event of a U.S.-led war with Iraq. Carrie Nolan, a member station WNYC, has more.
The New York Times and the Daily News say the plan, called Operation Atlas, will increase the number of police officers on street patrol and beef up security at bridges, tunnels, and landmark buildings, including houses of worship. The operation would reportedly involve groups of heavily armed emergency service officers, known as Hercules teams. Other specialized police and fire units would respond in the event of a terrorist attack. The reports say officials would also ask the Defense Department to deploy combat aircraft to patrol the skies over the city. The plan follows familiar advice from terrorism experts and calls on police to be alert for suicide bombers and to closely inspect subway cars and ferries for explosives. Mayor Michael Bloomberg is said to have been briefed on the plan, which police officials have said would cost the city $5 million a week. For NPR News, I'm Carrie Nolan in New York.
This is NPR News.
Good evening in Boston. I'm Gina Tempesta. U.S. Senator John Kerry made a surprise showing this morning at the annual St. Patrick's Day breakfast in Southie. Politicians had been roasting Kerry because he said he was not going to show up, but the 2004 presidential candidate did, and he wasted no time making fun of himself for the recent discovery that he was of Jewish heritage. The weather has apparently taken its toll on Trinity Church in Boston's Copley Square. The tile roof and stone tower are leaking, damaging priceless murals. Gusty winds have strained the church's stained glass windows as well. The Boston Globe reporting today that the parish will undertake a $42 million restoration beginning tomorrow. The Station Nightclub Fire Relief Fund has raised more than $1.3 million. The fund is collecting money for families and victims of the West Warwick, Rhode Island fire. That fund is now shifting its focus to long-term needs of victims and their relatives. And former Boston Bruins skated for a good cause today. The Boston Bruins alumni team faced off this afternoon at UMass Amherst Mullen Center to raise money for the Quinn Legacy Foundation. The foundation is named for Quinn Conley, a 12-year-old boy who died in December of 2000 while playing hockey in Springfield. It's 9:05. We're funded by you, our listeners, and by The MathWorks, creators of MathLab and Simulink technical computing software, dedicated to accelerating the pace of discovery in engineering and science worldwide. MathWorks.com. By Scotty Piano and Music, featuring the Yamaha Clavinova Piano, musical instruments and sheet music for professionals and beginners, lessons and marching band equipment. More at ScottyMusic.com. And by the Melville Charitable Trust, supporting efforts to find and fight the causes of homelessness, on the web at melvilletrust.org. In the forecast tonight, increasing clouds with patchy fog developing, temperatures rising into the mid-40s late, cloudy tomorrow, but warmer with highs in the 60s.
Good evening and welcome to Boston University's World of Ideas. I'm Ted O'Brien. Tonight, we hear another in a series of lectures presented by the African American Studies Program at Boston University as part of their Blacks and Asians in the Making of the Modern World series. Tonight, Professor Cedric Robinson of the University of California speaks on Jim Crow, capitalism, and the representation of blacks in early American cinema. Professor Robinson teaches in the Black Studies and Political Science departments of the University of California at Santa Barbara. He is the author of Black Marxism, The Making of the Black Radical Tradition, and Terms of Order, Political Science and the Myth of Leadership, as well as numerous articles on African and Western political and social theory. Professor Robinson.
The work that I'm currently pursuing is a study of early American film and the representation of race, which includes Asians and Latinos as well as blacks. And what I found very curious about looking into the historiography of American film is a number of deceptions that are critical to our understanding of what was happening in the silent films and in the pre-World War II period. I'm interested in prehistories because prehistories very often conceal what we most critically need to understand about the phenomena that has been brought to our attention. And in the context of the prehistory of American cinema, I spent some time a couple of years ago beginning to explore science libraries in this country because I was persuaded, unlike one of the critical figures in the literature of blacks in film, Bogle. Have any of you read Bogle's Toms, Coons, Mulattoes, Mammies, and Bucks? Bogle was about the... I guess he was younger than most of you when he wrote that book. He was in his early 20s. And it was, of course, it became a classic in the study of blacks in cinema, followed up by what I think was a much more historically sound series of books by Thomas Cripps, Slow Fade to Black, Making Movies Black, and so on and so forth. And now the literature is proliferating. One of the prehistories I was concerned about was, in effect, where did these stock constructions, Toms, Coons, and Mulattoes, Bucks, and Mammies, come from? And unlike Bogle, I resisted the notion that they were all of the same order. And indeed, they have uniquely different histories which are necessary to explore. One of the things I have become interested in is how science and printing and lithography in the early part of the 19th century played a role in developing the stereotypes and caricatures, the icons of blackness that appear in American film and continually are reiterated. And one of those was in Philadelphia, in the early teens of the 19th century and the 20s and 30s. The most important lithographers in this country all were from Philadelphia. Three of them, James Thackeray, Claypool, Johnston, and Edward Clay. And between 1816 and 1837, they produced these extraordinary images that I just wanted to alert your attention to, and then I want to move back to science. Now, this work has been not been seen very frequently. It is now beginning to appear. There's a book called Stylin. Have any of you know it? There's a chapter which deals with these figures. This is Thackeray, the first of the lithographers to come to terms with the black middle class in Philadelphia. This is 1819. What is very obvious in the transparency is that in conversation, black males employ much more language than their white counterparts. And that is because their mastery of the language is inefficient, inadequate. And as a consequence, there is a coincidence between their language and their dress. Though all four men are dressed rather fancifully, you'll notice that the black dress is a variation on, an elaboration of, and in fact a tasteless reiteration of their white counterparts. And Thacker, of course, emphasized what he was demonstrating by putting a monkey in the corner there. Another aspect of this cluster of three, Edward Clay, James Thackeray, and Claypool Johnston, was not merely their hostility towards the black middle class of Philadelphia, but their hostility towards abolition. And as a consequence, they produced these kinds of caricatures. One of the things that the black middle class in Philadelphia began doing in the 1820s was organizing balls. And their counterparts, the white women of the abolitionist society, did similar sorts of things. In 1837, a Haitian was invited to the black ball, and this became, in effect, the subject for this particular lithograph in that period. One other subject. As you know, the term miscegenation was not really invented until the Civil War, and before that, the term amalgamation was employed. So we have practical amalgamation, and what we see here is, on the one hand, with Thackeray, we see the appearance of the Zip Coon, and now with this particular image we see by Edward Clay, we see the emergence of the robust black woman who would in 20 or 30 years, be converted to the mammy. Now, let's get back to science. Any of you seen these images before? They were buried in Peabody for nearly a century. And a similar deception took place with Louis Agassiz. You remember when he died, his wife was the primary editor of his papers and his writings. Stephen Jay Gould found some of those papers which Mrs. Agassiz did not want to see the light of day. One of them was a letter written about 10 years before Agassiz commissioned these photographs, his first trip here to Philadelphia. And in Philadelphia, he was staying at a hotel. The service at the hotel was by black people, and he was in the dining room or whatever, and he saw this black man approaching him. Now, he writes this to his mother. He says, in effect, that he is so repulsed by the appearance of a black person that he was, in effect, paralyzed. And he could not scream or tell the man, "Don't come any closer," as the man was bringing his food. And the letter is full of these strange, semi-erotic, if not sub-erotic, nuances with respect to Agassiz. 10 years later, he commissions nude photographs of the black body, the body that so repulsed him. Agassiz, as Professor Hall indicates, was one of the staunchest polygynists in the country. Those who maintain that each race had a separate origin. And he taught his students that particular tradition or interpretation. And they, in turn, invested it in the Smithsonian. And so I was interested to see how this play between science and, in effect, race science and community played out in early American human science. So I was over at the Philadelphia, the Philosophical Society in Philadelphia, looking at some of the early texts of 19th and 19th century American scientists. And I came across a 1917 article written by a man of some prominence, also I believe his name was Gould, of some prominence in the Smithsonian apparatus. He, in fact, edited it and published all the Smithsonian's reports, journals, etc., for about 15 or 20 years. And he was the president of Sigma Chi, is that the science fraternity? In Washington, D.C., etc. And he told two stories in the midst of a description of the history of the secretaries, they are called, of the Smithsonians, the directors and heads of the Smithsonians. So he's moving right along, and at a certain point, he his article is illustrated by these prominent photographs of these eminent men, etc. And he says, he stops his narrative at a point and says, you know that because the Smithsonian has a collections of bones and skeletons, superstitious people find the place problematic, and we tried to hire a Negro man, and he... when we told him where we were going to employ him, he disappeared for 2 weeks. And then he went on into a second sort of folksy narrative about blackness and superstition. So I found it a very strange juxtaposition between, in effect, this homage to the leaders of the Smithsonian interfered with or... interrupted by these two strange tales about people of color. But then it became clear to me that with respect to this tradition, there was nothing in their imagination which was, in effect, problematic about that juxtaposition. As far as I can tell, and some of you know better perhaps, the subsidy of science for the purposes of race identification, the governmental subsidy, begins in the 1830s. In the 1830s, the United States Navy undertook a five-year expedition. And the results of that expedition was, in effect, many of the early collections of the Smithsonian's, butterflies, fish, etc., etc. The head naturalist of the expedition was a man named Pickering. And Pickering largely disappears from the annals of American science because he returns, and in the early 1850s, he publishes a book called The Races of Mankind. And in The Races of Mankind, he, in effect, voids the argument being championed at Harvard by Agassiz by maintaining that the entire human species is one, that it has a common origin, and that that common origin is Africa, and that the notion that slavery is racial is obviously contradicted by what he has seen on the monuments and in Egypt. He says clearly there are European slaves depicted there as well as African slaves depicted there. So the book disappears. Alternatively, his study of butterflies becomes a classic. Now, the second critical juncture between, or conjunction between, the government, capital, and race is during the Civil War, and race science is during the Civil War. Prior to the Civil War, I think just prior to the Civil War, in New York, is founded something called the Sanitation Commission. This will eventually become a federal structure known throughout the years as the Department of Health, Department of Health, Welfare, and so it begins as a cluster of folks in New York City. And they engage the government, and particularly the Army, during the Civil War in an effort to determine the efficiency of soldiery recruited from different ethnic groups and races, Iroquois, mulattoes, Irish, Germans, blacks, etc. And indeed, two parallel studies are occurring, one under the Surgeon General and one under the Sanitation Commission, of the same question. And the question involves the anatomical study of thousands of bodies, many of them dead, some of them alive. 12,000-14,000 non-blacks, a couple of thousand blacks, 800 mulattoes, 200 Iroquois, etc. Now, the critical question for the Sanitation Commissioner's subsidizers was initially the question around the Irish. The Irish were clearly an inferior race, but how critical was that inferiority with respect to the demands made on Irish soldiers in the Union Army? The results of that study were published in 69, the results indicate a number of really very interesting dispositions. First of all, understand the money for it came from Metropolitan Life Insurance, its predecessor operation, Prudential, etc. So this was an association between capital, the government, and science to determine, in effect, the vigor of different races as they were then conceptualized in mid-19th century United States. One result was it was very obvious to, and this dictated insurance policy premiums, etc., that mulattoes were less vigorous than either their parent races. How these are determined is a mystery to me, but nevertheless, there it is. The black soldiers were efficient, but they were incapable of creative, inventive, whatever have you, etc. And a follow-up study by a doctor named Hunt maintained he countered the argument of the Sanitation Commission group by saying, you know that most of the black soldiers that you were examining were slaves. For decades, there had been a depression of their education. He said, you can't determine what they are capable of on these grounds. And as you know, what about 80% of the black soldiers, about 190,000 of them, who served in the Civil War were slaves before the war. And so Hunt had it more right than wrong. The next critical juncture has to do with the title of my talk today, Jim Crow Capitalism and the Representation of Blacks in Early American Cinema. As you know, Jim Crow and American film appear historically at the same time, in the 1890s. Moving pictures and Jim Crow are coincident. And this coincidence becomes, in effect, a reason for, I believe, the kinds of constructions that one sees in American cinema in the 90s, as well as in the early 20th century, etc. Now, one of the things that I have discovered is that Jim Crow is the culmination of a series of adventures in how to dispose of, how to control the former slaves. And peonage, sharecropping, all those things are part of that apparatus. But perhaps the most ruthless of the new slaveries, and Oshinsky calls it in his title of his book, Worse Than Slavery, was, of course, the convict leasing program. The disposition of black labor through convict leasing achieved extraordinary dimensions. In fact, for decades, Florida built no prison because it had no intention of housing its prisoners. But in Mississippi and Georgia, Alabama, Arkansas, elsewhere, this extraordinary new industry of labor organization occurred, and it was critically associated with one particular adventure of capital, and that was the expansion of the railroads. So track was laid by convicts, most of them blacks. Timber was cut by convicts, most of them blacks. Resin was produced by convicts, most of them blacks. Blacks were in mines, the coal mines, etc. And many of the constraints of slavery had been removed. So many of these labor camps saw death rates of 40 to 50%. These were not forms of capital that had to be preserved. They could be worked to death, and they were worked to death. And the law of the states was transformed so that the law became an instrument of catchment for convict labor. And it was fairly indiscriminate in many ways. It caught a lot of whites in it as well, and it caught a lot of children. So Shoshinsky describes 12-year-old children and sometimes younger being caught in this new apparatus of labor recruitment. So Jim Crow is there and is attached to a kind of labor recruitment. And what I found very useful was the extent to which those involved in the railroads were implicated in the construction of race in the popular culture. Now, the most important spectacle of race in the end of the 19th century was the World's Fairs. You can begin in Philadelphia in 76, but I think, and these World Fairs were organized ostensibly to celebrate some historical event. 1876 would be what? The centennial. 1892, they didn't quite make it, but they planned to open it in 1892, but they opened it in 1893 in Chicago. And what would that be a commemoration of? 1892. Yes, it was the 400-year celebration of Columbus, and it became the Columbian Expedition. Exposition, I'm sorry. In 1892-3 and in 1904 in St. Louis, 1904, anything occur to you? It's called the Louisiana Purchase Exposition. A new racial regime had to be constructed because race now had to signify Native Americans, is that right? Native Americans, Filipinos, blacks, and a whole variation of Asians had to be, in effect, arranged in this new construction of race. In Chicago, of course, Ida B. Wells, Barnett, no, she wasn't a Barnett yet, Ida B. Wells and Frederick Douglass organized a protest against the fair, and they collaborated in developing a pamphlet, which was entitled roughly, "Why the Colored People Are Not at the World's Fair." So, but the one of the consequences of this attempt to embarrass the fair givers, fair makers, was that they gave us a Negro Day. So one day we were all supposed to come to the fair. And this was a Humor magazine's reconstruction of the day we came to the fair, Darkey's Day at the Fair. And this was all reiterated in narrative form, et cetera, et cetera. Darkest Day at the Fair. Now, the important thing about the fairs is understand, no television, no radio. Chicago, 1892-93, 27 million people. St. Louis, 1904, 19 million people. We're talking about a Chicago, a third of the country shows up to the fair, and they're invited to see these extraordinary exhibitions. In 1904, roughly 2,000 Filipinos are brought to the fair. 1904, this is that journalistic we see on CNN. Where are our troops and when will we, you know. I'm sorry I used it. It's horrible. But anyway, and between the Smithsonian, University of Chicago, and the Museum of Natural History, there was an agreement that we're going to be bringing a lot of Filipinos to St. Louis, all right, from the Philippines. You know what that means, gentlemen. Some of these people are going to die. And we should get it straight between us. Who gets the soft tissue? Who gets the skeletons? All right? And so in the freight cars shipping them from San Francisco to St. Louis, three of them die, and they are divided accordingly. A young Filipino American has done a film about his search for his grandfather's skeleton in American museums. It's called The Bontoc Eulogy, and B-O-N-T-O-C. Bontoc is a Igorot group, one of the Filipino peoples. And it's really an amazing piece of film. He's drawn a lot of documentary footage because Biograph Film Company was doing them. Biograph Film Company had sent a photographer to the Philippines to either cover the war or restage it, depending on whether he got to a battle in time or not. And so there's this extraordinary footage of the Philippines in the 1890s, late 1890s and early 1900s. But anyway, the Filipinos were exhibited. Among the Filipinos was, I think, something like 700 constabularies, Filipino policemen, because they were there to guard the Filipino exhibits from leaving the exhibits, their exhibition points, and becoming problematic. It was a very nice event. One Sunday, white school teachers from St. Louis high schools came and collected clusters of the constabularies to show them the rest of the fair, and they went around the fairgrounds. And at some point, Marines, who were the real guardians of the fair, caught up with them and chased the niggers back into the Filipino village, as they said. So here are, you can see this term, Igorot, and you can see some spectators watching these people. Some of you heard of Otabenga. Otabenga was at the fair. And since the human exhibits were arranged alphabetically, and Otabenga was a Chirichiri, a small man from Central Congo, and Geronimo was a Chiricahua, they were tented next to each other. And Otabenga remained in this country afterwards, after the fair was ended. You know, he was then housed in the monkey house in the Brooklyn Museum, Brooklyn Zoo, for a few weeks before some black preachers rescued him. When World War I broke out, he shot himself because the only way he could explain this extraordinary experience of his, you know, he's out fishing or hunting one day from his village. He returns and his whole village has been wiped out. And he begins to wander, and he wanders down the Congo River towards the Atlantic Ocean, where eventually he is encountered by a missionary, and ultimately the missionary, in effect, passes him on to people who are from the fair, organizers, collecting their specimens. He is disembarked in New Orleans, I think it is, and he's writing all this much later on as remembrances, memoirs. He encounters some of the musicians in the street musicians in New Orleans, and he is so saddened by their performance. He says, you know, because he sees them playing according to something that's on a piece of paper. He says, you know, they have been dead so long they have forgotten how to play, right? So they have to read music. There are these kinds of stories about the fair. The small people, you know, this was also the 1904 fair, also coincided with the 1904 Olympics, which was being held in St. Louis. And so it was an occasion for the anthropology department, because each of these fairs had an anthropology department. It was an occasion for the anthropology department to test the physical dexterity and muscular coordination of these specimens. So they brought the pygmies and out to play baseball. See, and if you know anything about these people's culture, they are very mischievous. And so they ran the bases backwards, and it was all covered in the local St. Louis newspapers, etc. And so, so there are those kinds of stories to be told about what was happening. But underneath it was indeed this extraordinary capital. The fairs were all, up until 1904, were all substantially subsidized in the tune of millions of dollars by railroad money. And you look up in Robert Rydell's All the World's a Fair, and you'll pass each fair. He does an extensive study of about 17 of them, because there were regional fairs in Buffalo and San Francisco and Omaha, as well as these world fairs taking place between 1876 and 1904. And you keep coming across railroads, the Vanderbilts. Who was the guy that did the Pullmans, George Pullman, right, et cetera, et cetera. And so this was the money behind the fairs, as well as, of course, some public subsidies. Now get to film itself. You all know about the role that Edison plays in the construction of film in the 1890s, and so I won't go through that. But it's very interesting to see the other kinds of companies that emerged. Now, American Mutoscope is the second largest company of the early 20th century. And they were doing films like Oh, That Watermelon, Watermelon Feast, Dancing Darkies, Hard Wash, A Black Woman, frustrated because no matter how hard she scrubs her child, the child never turns white, et cetera, et cetera. And this is all in the 1890s, 1896. American Mutoscope was incorporated end of 1895 and was bonded for $200,000 by the New York Security and Trust Company. The company's president was George Blanchard, one of the most prominent railroad executives in the country. Its first vice president was a national bank examiner, and on its board was E.J. Berwin, part owner of the Berwin and White Coal Mining Company. And one investor was Abner Kiff McKinley, who was the brother of the future American president. So Mutoscope is, in effect, the film extension of these railroad companies, as opposed to the Edison Group. And the same is true when Edison and Selig and the others moved together to become, in effect, the Trust in around 1912. There is a cluster of film-producing companies along with Eastman Kodak, which have become the Trust. That is, they require that for anyone outside of their group to make films, they have to pay fees, licensing fees. And in order to cement their control over filmmaking, they bring in Eastman Kodak, the only major producer of film stock in this country. So the maker of film stock, the people who claim that they control the copyrights and patents for various inventions, the camera, the projector, et cetera, are bonded together. And their control over the film industry lasts about 4 or 5 years. Their competitors, the renegades outside them, are called the independents. And what is ironic about our understanding of American film history is, of course, is that we know the independents, we don't know the trust, because the independents were Paramount, Fox, Universal, who else? Metro-Goldwyn-Mayer. So the big studios, which came to dominate film production after 1915, 1916, had been the independents. They were the ones who were, in 1910, 11, 12, forced to film secretly because they were using cameras which they hadn't paid fees to use. And Fox, of course, William Fox, who of 20th Century Fox, as we know it, Fox was one of the major figures behind that independent group. He took them to court, and the court The Supreme Court finally decided in 1914-15 that the trust was illegal, was unconstitutional. All right. So that was the breaking up of the trust. And now this new group came in to dominate filmmaking for about 10 years. And despite film historiography, they lose their control about 27, 28, 29. It's ironic because, according to the film historians, that's the period in which they begin to become... That's the period where we talk about... The film historians talk about the classic Hollywood studio period. Right? But the classic Hollywood studio period is when the Foxes and the Goldwyns and the Mayers and the Zuckers and Thalbergs and et cetera, become employees. They no longer control film. They only seem to control filmmaking because they have to report to the financiers in New York and Boston. Who controls film are the people who control the apparatus of sound. So sound brought new folks in, and primarily groups associated with Morgan, J.P. Morgan, and Rockefeller. That's where the control of film went in the late 1920s. But I want to back up a bit and take us to a very different story. I'm arguing that Jim Crow and the images in film were linked through a certain form of capital. That capital, which brought on the expansion of rails in the 1870s and 1880s, that capital which required Jim Crow in order to perfect its control over black labor, all right? And that the images that occur in early American film are complements to that control. That is, certain things that happened in the Civil War, certain things that happened in the populist movement in the 1890s, etc., which raised questions as to how efficiently could the working class be separated by race. All right? You know that it had collapsed during the Civil War. What's your name? Have any of you seen this book published last year called The Free State of Jones? Jones is a county in central Mississippi. And in 1864, slaves and poor whites in Jones County seceded from the Confederacy. Seceded from the Confederacy and fought Confederate troops. All right? Free State of Jones. And the Confederate officer who eventually defeated these black-white rebels became governor of Mississippi. Du Bois had talked about, as you know, in his Black Reconstruction, about what he thought was the Great Strike that had occurred during the Civil War. And we are just beginning as, I think her name is Victoria Bynum, who's written The Free State of Jones. She's a descendant of the Bynums who were in The Free State of Jones in 1860. And she's written the book in response to other constructions of it, which are important to American film. One of the other descendants, or two of the other descendants, had written accounts of Jones in the 1940s and the 1950s. One of them was severely impressed by Margaret Mitchell, Gone with the Wind, et cetera, et cetera. And so she had said the Free State of Jones was precipitated by a mulatto slave who seduced all these white men and brought them into rebellion against the Confederacy. All right. Now that is an important narrative tale. All right, because it takes us back to Tom Coon's Mulatto's Bucks and Mammies. And my final comments about what I'm doing and what it signifies. You know, the mulatto appears in American popular culture maybe as early as 1850s on stage. And the mulatto is a mechanism for the abolitionist movement. The mulatto is placed on stage in order to provide a white audience with the experience of slavery through a white character. She is a young woman who has been raised white, and on the death of her father, it's revealed to her that she is both her father's daughter and her father's property. And now that he is dead, she will be disposed of as the rest of his property is, by auction, by sale, etc. So she is a white woman who is suddenly a black woman who is suddenly a slave. That's the origins of the mulatta in American literary as well as theater history. In the post-Civil War period, the mulatta is seized, appropriated by sympathizers of the Old South and of Jim Crow. And so she appears in both their literature in the 1880s and 1890s, and then in the films that they construct in the early 20th century. She appears as a Jezebel, as this seductress. D.W. Griffith in Birth of a Nation takes an actual relationship, that of Thaddeus Stevens and Lydia Hamilton Smith, and turns it into Austin's, in the film Birth of a Nation, the leader of the radical Republicans becomes Austin Stoneman. Austin Stoneman, and his mistress is Lydia Brown. And Austin is clubfoot the way Thaddeus Stevens is clubfoot, and Lydia Brown is a mulatta just as Lydia Hamilton Smith was a mulatta. And in Birth of a Nation and in the imaginations of Dixon and Griffith, it was Lydia Hamilton Smith who drove Thaddeus Stevens towards a hatred of the Confederacy and precipitated the pushing of the radical Republicans into a militant militant abolitionism. So that gives you an instance of how I differ from Bogle in the construction of this iconography. I said it has different histories. The Mammy has a different history from the mulatta. The mulatta has a different history from the coon. The coon has a different history from the tom, and so on, and the buck, et cetera, et cetera. And it's interesting that some of them begin as images which are sympathetic to blacks, and then eventually become images which are hostile to blacks. All right. So the last thing I wanted to show you is an excerpt from, how many of you have seen Within Our Gates? Within Our Gates is a suppressed film. All right. It's a film that was done in 1919, released in 1920, by the most prolific of the black filmmakers, a man named Oscar Michaud. How many of you know about Oscar Michaud? Okay. Oscar Michaud produces a film called Within Our Gates. The film is banned by Virginia. The film is snatched by the Chicago censors, etc., and the film disappears. For over 60 years. The film is found in the early 1990s in Madrid, Spain. All right. The film has traveled to Spain. It has been translated into Spanish. Remember, it's a silent film. So all the intertitles are in Spanish. Now the film has been recovered in Spain, and it is brought back to the Library of Congress, where the librarians attempt to translate back into Michaud's English the Spanish, all right? The film in Spain was called La Negra, the Black Woman, all right? And Michaud's original title is Within Our Gates. It is the only black independent film that displays a lynching, and this is why the film was banned in 1920. So I want you to look at the Mammy, and I want you to look at the Mulatta. This is a black family that's been... the male has been accused of shooting a white planter, and they are in hiding in the woods. There are four in the family, mother, father, and two children. This is Michaud telling you don't believe what you read in newspapers. So this is the lynch mob. Now look at what happens to her very closely. She's undressed. Now the father is responding to the lynch mob. She's protecting her son. She becomes sexualized in this sequence, unlike the mammies everywhere else in American film. But think about the black images which were dominant in that period and see how many violations are occurring. Look at the mob, women, children, ordinary people. This is the brother of the man who's been killed for which the lynch mob is trying to achieve revenge. The mother and father have been killed, and the mob is now preparing to burn their bodies. This is their surviving daughter. Now, all this takes place in the last third of the film, and it is a flashback because her story is being told to her current beau by her cousin. What I try to do in the larger study is to begin to explain how black filmmakers responded to the degradation that was occurring in film. And here was, for the earliest period, 1919, 1920, the most definitive rejoinder to Birth of a Nation and to these other films, which were numerous. But understand this. Black filmmakers, their strategy was to respond to the degradation of blackness in general by promoting the mulatto. Be clear, on the one hand, in mainstream American films, if you can use that term, blacks were clowns, dark-skinned blacks were clowns. Mulattoes were dangerous. 1915, The Nigger, a film done by Fox. A man has just been elected governor, and his cousin, who is a bootlegger, or at least he sells alcohol, comes to him and says, you've got to veto this bill, prohibition bill, that the legislature is putting together. He says, no, I'm not going to do that. He says, yes, you are, because you're a nigger. Your grandmother was a nigger, and I have a letter to prove it. And unless you tell, unless you veto this bill, right, I'm going to expose you. And this woman that you're trying to marry, right, she's not going to like you anymore either. Right? So you see the mulatto being employed over and over and over again. This is the only instance I've given you of the film called The Nigger. That's the only instance of I can find of a sympathetic treatment of the mulatto. But over and over and again in these films, mulattoes went crazy. What you saw in this film, Within Our Gates, was a reenactment, in a sense, of the rape or attempted rape of Lillian Gish in Birth of a Nation. There, the cross-cutting is between Ride to the Rescue, as the film theorists put it, that is, the Klan is riding to the rescue, and in the meanwhile, Silas Lynch, a mulatto, a freak of nature. Mulattoes are freaks of nature, and as a consequence, they are oversexed and they're incapable of self-discipline, and they enjoy power. Lydia has the same sort of reactions. Lydia Brown is the same creature that that Silas Lynch is. In the novel, Dixon's novel, The Leopard's Spot, where he treats with Lydia in some detail, he describes her as a jungle animal. Griffith portrays her in the same way. So what Michaud has done is use the same language that Griffith employed, cinematic language, cross-cutting. He's cross-cutted in a way that, in effect, two radically different stories are taking place. The lynchings, which are praised in Birth of a Nation because they have to do with the virtue of the white race, in particular white woman, that is reversed in Within Our Gates. Who is the woman who is to be raped? Who are the women who are most frequently raped? Black women, Michaud says, not white women. Are the mobs noble? No, the mobs are not noble. They are very often directed by evil men employing the mob to do their nastiness. So lynching is not virtuous. It is not a noble act. It is an act of cowardice and meanness. And the black woman, the mammy and the mulatta, the mammy who in Birth of a Nation fights off black soldiers and white soldiers because she's a slave of this important Confederate family, fights them off physically, right, because of her loyalty to the white family, that black woman is eroticized by Michaud. He strips her. As he strips her, He shows her bare arms. He shows part of her breast. And he shows her passion for her commitment to her family. And, of course, the Mulatta, and you've only seen, this is Michaud's longest silent film, the Mulatta is this noble creature who's committed to the race. And the reason why we have to have this backstory, the reason why you have to have this flashback within our gates, is because she seems totally desexed. She has two suitors in this film, and there are barely any sensual erotic moments between them. And why is she so dedicated to the race that she has forsaken romance and love and passion? Her cousin, who has betrayed her early in the film, now feels guilt and tells her current suitor, the man who would marry her, Sylvia, says, you have to understand, she's had this horrible history. This horrible history where the family she thought was hers was lynched, where a man who tried to rape her turned out to be her father. And so Within Our Gates inverts all of the nastiness that you see in D.W. Griffith. But the more critical thing is, beyond the aesthetics of particular films, is to begin to sense how Capital influences the construction of race in American film. It's a moment in which Michaud's predecessors, primarily in the black musical and in the theater, have chased the dominance of race from the American theater. They have taken over minstrelsy. So in the 1890s, early 1900s, in Abyssinia and Dahomey, just like white folks, these musicals, black musicals, have become the dominant minstrel form. And in these black musicals, you see these extraordinarily beautiful black women, from Ida Walker to Dora Dean. But you have reconstructions of African and American black history in ways that are very subversive of what you found in blackface minstrelsy. So they've chased the minstrels from the American stage, and they are transferred to American film, where Capital protects them from substantial challenges.
Thank you. Professor Cedric Robinson of the University of California at Santa Barbara, speaking on Jim Crow, Capitalism and the Representation of Blacks in Early American Cinema. For a CD or cassette of Boston University's World of Ideas, call 1-800-909-9287. That's 1-800-909-9287. CDs and cassettes are $15 and include shipping and handling. Tonight's program was produced by Andy Farnsworth, with help from John Hoder and Michael Garth. Our web producer is Angel Cazelli. I'm Ted O'Brien. Thanks for joining us.
This is WBUR. We're funded by you, our listeners, and by the New England Spring Flower Show, previewing spring with more than 2 million flowers, gardening tips, landscaping ideas, and more at Boston's Bayside Expo Center now through Sunday, March 23rd. By Tech Superpowers, providing Apple Macintosh sales, service, and training. On-site Mac help for enterprises and small businesses across Metro Boston. Technology for genius. And by Color Tech, photographic and digital processing services for the imaging consumer, a campus camera in Kenmore Square, 727 Atlantic Avenue and 290 Main Street in Kendall Square. Coming up just ahead at 10 o'clock, it's the latest on today's Azores Summit and other world news from the BBC.
That's the sound of a grand piano without strings. From now till this Wednesday, without strings. From now till this Wednesday.